This is the Need to Know podcast from the Computer Information Agency with information for business and IT professionals. To support this podcast, visit donation.ciaops.com. This is episode 47 with Justin Handley. Welcome along to the Need to Know podcast from the Computer Information Agency. My name is Robert Crane, and in this episode, I am joined by Justin Handley. Justin, welcome.
Thank you.
As we do on our podcast regularly, we'll get our guest to introduce himself and let us know who he is and what he does. So, Justin, if you can let the audience know exactly that.
Sure. I am a business owner. I've run a company called Narasopa Media for about the last 13 years, and we've evolved a lot over time. It started out as a pretty basic web design company, and at some point I realized that having a website didn't actually serve anyone. Having an effective website is what was important. And so I got more into the marketing side of things and understanding conversion rates and optimizing marketing. And now I mostly work with existing businesses to help them grow. I work as a business growth consultant, or I call it a business architect, because I like to go in and put together the pieces to really make a business, you know, stand up over time. So,
cool. All right.
That's me.
One of the things you mentioned there, which I think would be quite interesting for us to explore a bit on, is you talk about, an effective website. I mean, in this day and age, what's your definition of, an effective? What does a website for a small business need to be effective these days?
Well, ultimately, that really depends on what the business is. The effective, I try to measure everything by whether or not you're achieving a goal. So maybe you're a nonprofit and your goal is to get donations in, or maybe your goal is to get your message out. And that's two different goals that you've got. Maybe you're a business. And if you're a business, there's different levels. There's the Amazon.com store type businesses where your goal is really overall sales. It's not necessarily a specific product sale. I work with a lot of coaches and consultants where they sell a book and maybe a more expensive training program, and then they do live seminars. And so they've got, the goal of let's sell the book, but then let's upsell those people into my program. And maybe if they also do speaking, there's a whole different track where they're actually going out to companies and trying to get companies to recruit them to speak. And so that's its own goal. And so the first thing is defining what's your goal. What is it that you're trying to do? It's very easy for single product companies, people who have just made one thing and want to sell it. The goal is to sell that one thing. And it can get a lot more complex from there, depending on what kind of business you're in.
Okay.
And so the website ultimately is, a good website is a website that serves that goal. It's not about how it looks or what it says, but whether or not it helps you achieve what you're trying to do.
Okay, so let's be specific. Let's say that I'm a service business, typically an IT service business. So I'm typically selling my ability to maintain, your computers, your network, your technology systems. It's not necessarily a physical product. It's basically more a service product. I mean, can you get more definitive as to what that sort of website should and shouldn't include?
Sure. So almost across the board, it's funny because I actually work with exactly who you're talking about. And one of the things that we've done to help them is, really for them, the thing is to get people to pick up the phone. Nobody buys their services online. People talk to them. People feel out whether they're the right company. And then they do a free consultation on site. So the goal is to get people to call and ask for a free consultation so that you can show up and say, well, your server's about to crash and your networking is terrible and you're going to lose everything if you don't hire me, which typically is what gets said. And so we took two approaches. One is free stuff these days is fantastic. It needs to really be something valuable. People are so used to getting free things that it's become a little harder, but still, I would say to establish yourself as an expert, giving people something that they can do for free and for very low cost, as little as you can ask them to do, but where they feel like they're getting a value is a good thing. And to try to engage them and hopefully get their email that way so that you can continue communication. because the number one step is you definitely want to get people to engage with you far enough that you get their email address or their phone number so that you can follow up, because otherwise they're lost. They hit your website. If they don't give you some information to contact them, you'll never see them again. And so we set up a free consultation offer, which is fine, but that's kind of a high touch offer. You really have to want to talk to someone on the phone, get them into your business to do that. And so then we're working on right now setting up a more interactive game style thing where it's just a questionnaire, it's just a fancy survey, but where you can answer questions on that survey. You can say, yes, my business has this, we don't have this, we do have this, and kind of based on yes and no logic, then the website can kick them back a custom, like, well, this is your number one priority, okay? You don't have backup, you need data backup, here's options. And, you know, so if there are ways to engage people like that, on a very simple level, you could write a report, you know, the 10 top things you need to know about home networking. That's a pretty common way to do it. But something like that that will get people to engage with you so that you can then follow up with them. If they don't decide to schedule an appointment right away, you want to be able to kind of drip content on them over time so that they get to trust you, get to know that you know what you're talking about, and eventually might become a sale.
So, I mean, do you really, you know, do people actually read white papers? Are they actually going to download something and take the time to, you know, go through the, you know, the 10 important steps or do a checklist? Aren't they generally just bouncing from site to site to site looking for help?
It depends. I mean, in that industry, there is definitely the emergency section. There are people whose network just crashed and they are going to hire the first person who gives them a reasonable quote. And in that case, the, you know, really search engine rankings is all that matters. You just got to be on page one. You've got to have your phone number on the page. They're going to call you and they're going to say, hey, my network is down. I need you right now. And maybe you can help. There are a lot of people, though, that white papers are pretty boring. Some people read white papers. I think the more corporate you get, if you serve big corporations, people are more likely to read white papers. If you serve small businesses, they're more likely to read like 10 tips or something that fits on one page or watch a video. Definitely people do that.
Okay.
In almost every field. I've got clients in a lot of different fields, and there are a huge number of people that will go for a download any day of the week over actually engaging personally.
Okay, so what sort of material, you know, should you be giving as a download? Obviously, not necessarily in the SMB market. You're looking for a, you know, a fairly boring white paper. I mean, you know, how long? What content should it be? Is it the top 10 things that you should be doing? I mean, my feeling is that seems to be played out a lot. I mean, do you have to do something that's markedly different to actually get them to download it?
It depends on who you are and where you are and what your market is. If you're going after a local market, I'd say that you can really lower the bar. If you're going after a national or an international market and you really want to establish market presence, interestingly, I think that one of the most important things is personality. So it's not actually content, but it's the way that that content comes across, because people these days are into social media. They're into things being personal. It's all instant. They can give feedback on companies, and, you know, Kickstarter's taken off where people self-fund businesses just because they like the idea or they like the people behind it. And so I think that one thing now is really transparency and having a personality to your marketing message, so that it's not just bland, boring, we're another company. You wanna stand out, and part of standing out now is having your personality on that message as well as the content that you need. And beyond that, it can vary widely. People let you download entire books. People will give you a one-page report. You know, video is very common these days and often has higher conversion rates. So, and it's getting easier to do. There's a lot of services where you can actually just, you know, turn on your webcam, talk to it, do post-production right there on the computer, and have a pretty nicely produced video just from sitting in front of your computer and talking for a minute. So that ultimately has to be tested by market. Different markets prefer different things. You know, if you're serving people who are at work when they read their email a lot, you don't really want to do video because they're not going to turn on a video and have the audio play. You know, if you have a market that's more looking for you at night, at home, they might be more likely to engage with longer videos.
Okay, so You obviously want them to get down to download your content. You want to capture their details. Are you looking to capture that at the point of download? You know, getting to put in their email address before they get the free content, or are you going to give them the content in the hope that the information in there, they'll come back and start engaging with you from there?
Well, I would say that as a rule, you can give away some things for free on your website. As a rule, you want to try to get people to give you their contact info right up front. So the less you have to give to get their contact info, the better. Because ultimately, you had a good point. I mean, I would say 80% of people will never, ever watch or read what they asked for. But as long as they asked for it and gave you an email address, you then have the capability to write back to them. And, you know, so maybe you give them a half-hour video. No one ever watches it. But you send them 5 emails over the next 2 weeks that are like, hey, did you see the part of the video where I talked about this? This is really important to you. And, you know, so that now you've got them in a way that you can communicate and you can establish a rapport with them over time. And that's really the key. So whether they consume that original content or not, you want them to. You want to drive them to do that. The more, and if you can track who's doing that, even better, because then you know who's engaging with you more deeply. But even if they don't, you've at least got a way that you can follow up and communicate with them from there on out, you know. Not to be underestimated too, in the digital age, is free shipping offers. You know, hey, we'll send you a free sample or a free copy of my book or a free CD or DVD, you know, in the mail. And then you've actually got people's physical address. Oftentimes you can do, like, we'll ship it to you for $1, and then you've got their credit card on file, so that in the future they can just log in, their information's on file, they can make other purchases with you, you know. So there are, the more deeply you can get people to engage right away, the better. And it's something that you just have to balance, because at some point, if you ask for a lot up front, you're just going to turn people off. So you've got to find out how much can you ask for in exchange for what you have to give, without making people mad.
Okay, so
not wanting to give you anything.
So do you do this as a campaign? So do you put it up there and you try it for, you know, say, you know, a month or 2 months, and you get the, you know, you get the metrics in, and then you adjust it and move forward, or you know, or try something different? I mean, do you do it, or do you just put it up there and leave it up there as a constant lead generator potentially?
Well, I think that also depends on market. If you've got something successful, I tend to leave it as long as possible. At some point, you will hit market saturation if you're doing a good job getting it out there, and everybody will have seen it. So it's important to have new things coming out. That doesn't mean that you should switch it, though. You shouldn't necessarily take down old things to put up something new. If you have something that's working, you leave it there. You know, there's new people coming into your market all the time. People who weren't interested before and now are, people who have changed jobs or moved and, you know, now are in your sphere of market. So if you've got an effective piece, I would tend to leave it alone, and instead of thinking about replacing it, think about improving it. And so maybe run a test on your copy, possibly run a test on the actual content that you're giving. You know, so you could test 2 pages, one saying, hey, watch this free 30-minute video where we talk about the important aspects of networking, versus, hey, download a free report or checklist that you can go through your network and make sure you're secure, versus, hey, take our little online quiz to make sure that you've got a safe network. You could put all 3 of those offers out there at one time, test them and see what your market responds to best, and then, you know, throw the other 2 away and then come up with a new idea and test that, so that you're always improving. But typically improving like that is incremental, so that you're not actually just throwing away what you have and doing something entirely different. You're taking whatever you had and you're saying, you know, how can I make this better inch by inch?
Okay, so let's say that you've done the initial, you know, you've done the initial white paper or the video, and you've captured their details, and that's generally a once off. The prospect's not going to return necessarily to that page again to view that video or to take that quiz again. What's the next step that you would suggest taking to continue that engagement?
Well, so then you go into what's called the nurture process, and you want to fundamentally take a client, make them like you, and make them want to buy whatever it is that you're selling. And so once you've got them, I would say that typically for a week or two, I do nothing except continue giving them more stuff. And so maybe if you've got this big report that you did and that's your free thing that you're giving away, you know, you point out things that were in it. You go back and you say, hey, did you see on page 18 where we talk about this? You write a paragraph or two that's a little bit more in depth on that point. You encourage people to actually consume whatever they first asked for, to go through it and actually use it and read it. And you also give them a little bit more, but you don't really ask for anything. You just keep giving and educating, because usually people have signed up to be educated, whether that's about, you know, how to run your network or how to get your hair cut right or how to bake bread well or whatever it is, the niche that you're serving, they came to learn something. And so you want to first teach them and then subtly over time start introducing, and did you know that working with my company can make it easier like this, or can save you money, or what are the benefits of working with you over working with someone else or trying to do it yourself, you know? And then eventually after a couple of weeks, typically moving into harder sells. Because usually if someone hasn't bought after a month, you can throw them on a long-term list that you send out your newsletter to, and every once in a while somebody will come back and buy from you, or maybe buy things that you're promoting of other people's and engage. But usually if they ask for something about a specific product or service and they haven't engaged in a month, I just put them on like a maintenance list where maybe once a month or every couple of weeks they get a newsletter-style email. So that they know that I exist. But really, over the first 30 days, I do a week of just babysitting and giving them more, a week of introducing the idea that by working with me or the company, they can, or by buying the product, you know, they can have it easier, better, faster, cheaper, whatever. And then a week of basically saying, buy or forget about it. And that can be by doing sales. Hey, we've got 10% off. It only lasts until this weekend. It can be by doing, you know, just putting a little bit more pressure on so that anyone who's on the fence and hasn't already decided to buy from you has a little added motivation to, whether it's a discount or a time limited bonus or, you know, something else that makes it like, you know, take action now and not next year. Okay. Because people will put off whatever they can.
Of course. Okay. So here's another question for you. Why would I bother doing, what sort of emphasis should I put on Facebook? I mean, you know, we've got the website and that generally tends to be static. Isn't it a better idea to be more engaging with an audience via, you know, a social media, via something like Facebook, where you've got, you know, conversations and likes and metrics and all that sort of stuff? Isn't that a better medium to do that sort of engagement you're talking about?
Well, that is a tricky one. There are places where Facebook is good, and there are places where it's a waste of money. I mean, I actually, against the flow of current trends, don't usually recommend doing almost anything on social media for small businesses. You know, a lot of people, we actually offer social media management as one of the services my company offers, and I almost never sell it because usually the people who ask me about it don't need it. You know, who needs social media management is a company that's being talked about so much that they need to manage it. Like, they need to respond. They've got customer service requests coming in over social media. They've got people saying bad things about them. They've got people saying good things that they want to collect. You know, at that point, when you've generated that much buzz, yes, go for the social media and go all out. You know, until then, I've had great results with paid advertising on Facebook. I've had good results with kind of very direct communication. So for example, I work with a company called Infusionsoft. I'm a certified consultant. They have a private Facebook group for certified consultants. We pass work around. So if somebody can't do it, they're like, hey, can you take this job? Right? So I get work that way. But that's because it's a very specific group and it's very specific to what I'm doing. I haven't ever worked with a company, and that doesn't mean that companies aren't doing it, but I haven't ever worked with a small business that actually has measurable, significant ROI off of social media.
Okay, but would it be fair to say, do that? I mean, should they ignore the social media altogether, or should they, put up a Facebook page, or or like I say, as you mentioned, should they ignore it totally? What sort of strategy makes the most sense?
I would say definitely have a presence, put up a page. You know, if you're blogging, and blogging is a great thing to do. It's good for SEO. It's good to establish credibility. And you can set up plugins that when you write a blog post will automatically publish it out to Facebook, Twitter, LinkedIn, and like 180 other social networks if you're a member of them. That's one easy way, is to kind of take the passive approach. I would say definitely have a page for your business. Have a way people can become fans. People will look for you on Facebook. And so then you need to post something, whether it's once every 2 weeks, but it can be very low key, low maintenance. And then you'll get a notification. So if somebody posts back, certainly interact. You know, I would say that if people come to you and interact with you, definitely respond, interact back. But ultimately, as a promotional strategy, unless you are an awesome viral content creator and you've got something that people will pass around, you know, which is the one model that really works. If you've got something people will pass around, certainly go for it. Get it out there, share it with everyone you know, see if they'll pass it around. Try to do the kind of tell a friend campaign through Facebook. That's one way you can do it. Most people and most businesses are not, you know, don't have the creative force to do something that's really going to go viral like that.
And what sort what sort of resources do you need to devote, to this sort of thing? I mean, is it, obviously it's something that the business owner can do, or, I mean, how regularly should you be, making these touches and looking at this sort of stuff? Is it an hour a week sort of investment, or is it, more than that? I mean, obviously, it would depend, but, what sort of time do you think you should be allocating to these sort of activities?
Well, I'd say whatever feels natural, because with social media, by nature, it's social, and people, you can tell when someone's just selling you instantly, and it turns people off. People don't want to be just sold on Facebook. They want to engage. And so if you actually have engaging stuff and you're into posting it and you're on there, great. Do as much as you can. If it's really not your medium, I would say keep it at a minimum. Yeah, an hour a week. I mean, one or two posts a month. You can, like I said, you can set up auto posting where you write an article for your website. You actually are kind of duplicating your work then, because you post it on your site, it pushes out to social media. You never have to log in to any of the social media sites to do that. That's a really easy way to take care of it. Otherwise, there are things, like Hootsuite is one for sure. And I think it costs $10 a month, but it lets you link up all your social profiles into one place so you can go and post one message and put it out to all of your networks, so that you could log in. You save a lot of time. You just have something to say. You log into one thing, you post it, it posts all your networks. And it also aggregates back to you messages incoming so that you'll see what people are writing to you, so that if you did just want to spend a couple minutes a week, you go in, you write one post, you see if anyone's written back to you. If they did, you write back to them, and that's kind of it.
Okay.
So
here's another question. I see, fairly common. I see a lot of people doing this. Is the way that you approach social media or Facebook, or whether should you be mixing, and you talked about having, a personalized part of your business and people, deal with people rather than entities. What's the thinking on mixing, some of your personal content into your business, say in Facebook? So I see a lot of businesses, they set up a small business, one man, two man operator, set up a Facebook page, but they do it for their business, but it ends up including a lot of their, their personal content. They're checking in here, or they're doing this, or pictures of their family, or things like that. I mean, is that something that, you should be doing as best practice, or you should be separating the two profiles, keeping personal, and business?
Well, I guess that's largely preference. I think that if your customer base is interested in who you are, it might make sense to post personal stuff sometimes. I keep it pretty separate. I also have a problem that a lot of people these days have, because there's, a lot of people do a lot of things, and I also play in a band. So I run my company, but I play in a band. It's two very different messages. One's pretty corporate consulting. One is rock and roll. And so I have my Facebook page where I'm just me, and I have pictures of my family, and I put stuff about my business and all about everything I do. You know, it's like my thing, but I really only, some people will be friends with anyone as a promotional thing on their personal page. I don't recommend that. I recommend keeping your personal page personal so that you can have relationships with, you know, that kind of inner group. And then on the business page, I might post stuff every once in a while, like, if it's relevant, hey, I went out to dinner last night and they did this, and I thought that was a really cool thing from a marketing perspective, because I tie it back because I'm a marketing consultant. I don't just say, hey, I went out to dinner at this restaurant on my business page.
So the secret obviously is if it's relevant to the business in some way, like they gave you good service or that was you saw a good gadget or whatever, there needs to be that tie back to the business to make it relevant.
Yeah, I think so. And with, you know, Facebook, everything doesn't get pushed out. So it's not like email. It's not like you're sending your whole email list an email that's like, hey, I went out to dinner last night, it was great, which would make everyone unsubscribe really quickly. Like, you're not going to keep people that way. On Facebook, it's a little bit, not everybody sees all your updates. It's more sporadic. It happens in a timeline. So I think that you do want it to look, though, if somebody comes and looks at your company page and you look through all your previous posts, you want it to make sense. You want it to be cohesive and to be business and about your business and what you do. You don't want it to necessarily, when somebody looks at it, you want them to get it. You don't want them to look at your Facebook page and think like, I don't understand this. Is this, who is this? What is this? You know, you want it to be really clear what you do, because that's usually why they're coming to see you or maybe be a fan, is because they're interested in what your business is and what it's doing.
Okay, so, I mean, all of this website, social media, Facebook, and all that sort of stuff, you know, driving promotions and driving business. I mean, even at a small business level, is it something that you need to sit down and map out a strategy? Do you need to, you know, say, look, this is what I'm trying to achieve, and this is how I'm going to do it? And rather than, it seems to me that, you know, a lot of people go into it with the best of intentions, and they start a blog and they write, you know, 3 articles, and then they never write another article again. You know, to be effective, you need to do it, you know, on a regular basis as part of a strategy. But is the first step in achieving that to, like you mentioned before, is to actually sit down and define exactly what you're trying to achieve, and then these are the tools and this is how I'm going to go about it?
I would say so. And another good rule of advice with blogs and with social media is, if you aren't going to do it, don't do it. You know, if you have a company page and all you did was upload a header graphic and there's no comments and there's no posts, it's not ever going to do anything for you. And so if it's not in your blood to go out there and post on it every once in a while, I would say, you know, just don't even go there. Or you could set up a Facebook page and in the header graphic, you know, write one post that says, hey, visit our website at blah, 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 and try to drive people back that way. The likelihood that that ever gets you any traffic is low. So even doing that, you know, is questionable. So I guess that...
Well, what about the situation where, you know, a lot of, you know, especially a lot of technical people generally, you know, a majority of them aren't particularly good at writing script or, you know, necessarily doing blog posts or, you know, being able to communicate on a regular basis. What about, you know, if they got ghostwriters or if they took content from other locations that they were allowed to? I mean, is that something they should be putting on their blog, or do they really need to keep, as you mentioned, the personal touch, you know, from the editor's desk sort of thing?
Oh, my preference is the personal touch. I mean, you can, if you have a good ghostwriter, you can write books that way. You can write all of your content that way. And that's fine if they're a good ghostwriter. I would say going out and getting what they call like spun content, where stuff has been mildly rewritten to be unique. You know, anything that's not good, I wouldn't publish, because publishing stuff that seems like it was thrown together is kind of worse than not publishing anything. You don't want people to read what you've got to say and think like, wow, this guy does not have any idea what he's talking about, you know, because that's worse than them going and thinking, huh, I wonder what this is about. You know, there's not really that much information here. So I'd say that if you're using ghostwriters, you just want to make sure that they're good and that they, you know, and by good, what I mean, I guess, is that they can get your business, they can get your voice, and they can write something that sounds like you would have written it even if you didn't.
So I suppose in all of this, the most important thing is basically the metrics, is measuring it to make sure. I mean, you could sit there thinking that, you know, you're writing the greatest blog post in the world and basically you're not getting hits, nobody's reading it. I mean, is that, you know, just as an important part is to make sure that you're doing the metrics and the follow-up and, you know, understanding, you know, your audience and what they do like to consume and what is working?
Sure. SEO is a tricky game, though. So a blog, if you have a built-in audience, like if you have an email list already, or if you have people that come to your site on a regular basis and you've got good traffic, then you can write blog posts and you can absolutely measure how many people read them and kind of determine in that way what content they like and what they don't. If you don't have a lot of existing traffic or a big email list, you know, one of the big things about writing a blog is that it's a great way to get some search engine traffic naturally and relatively cheaply, but a lot of that actually can't be measured post by post, because I could write 10 posts this month and it's a brand new site and I'm just writing a blog and I've got 10 posts out and no one's coming. But a lot of the SEO game is about consistency. Google checks your site, and if you're writing once a week, Google will check your site once a week. And if they come and you haven't written anything in a month, they'll turn you down and they'll check your site once a month. And if you're writing daily, they will index your site daily. And based on that, you've got, you know, kind of a regularity to how you're writing and how you're being indexed. Then the more you write, the more likely you are by accident to write words that people search that relate to your business, that bring in traffic. So I think that if you're doing blogging from that perspective of traffic generation and trying to get people in, the more you write, the better. And the more you write, the more likely it is that you will get indexed and start getting good rankings. And then once one of your articles gets good rankings, the other ones will start to get picked up because they're on the same domain. And, you know, the more and the longer that you write a blog, the better it is from an SEO perspective. Otherwise, if you don't have a lot of traffic and you're really trying to test messaging, it's a lot easier just to, you know, throw up a couple different blog posts or a couple different opt-in offers that are completely different and pay for some traffic to go through them, so that you can gauge your market that way.
Okay, so if we're doing a blog, I suppose another question I see a lot is do you do the blog on a publishing platform like Blogger or WordPress or whatever, or do you bring it internal and do it on your own website?
I use WordPress internally. So I use, you know, WordPress has WordPress.com, which you can sign up for a blog on, and they have WordPress.org, which is an open source software that you can install on your site. Every site I've built in the last 8 years has been on WordPress. I'm a WordPress junkie. And so I guess that's my answer. And the reasons for that would be you get more flexibility. You have total control over your entire site and software. And if you want to grow and do fancy things, you can. Whereas if you're on WordPress.com and you want to grow and do fancy things, it's harder because it's their software. It's their limited packages. It's a trickier proposition than you just owning your site. And these days, WordPress isn't just a blogging platform. It's also a real content management system. So you can build out your entire site and your blog all in one place. It's relatively easy to learn. And there's, you know, the biggest market out there for people who can either admin it if you don't have time, or people who can design. Almost every kid out of college web designer understands WordPress these days because it's a very common platform. And so that's my preference. And I think that also you get more credible, better traffic over time. There have been some things. You know, we used to start Blogger blogs for SEO because Google owned Blogger, and so Google indexed Blogger, and so they would index those posts. But again, it's a limited blog scenario. You can't do a whole lot with it. And so at some point it just becomes, you know, you've got traffic coming, but you can't actually do what you want with the site. So it's a debatable question. I mean, I think there's a lot of different answers, but you know, the installed version of WordPress is what I use for about everything.
Yeah, obviously it's going to give you more flexibility running it yourself. But again, the thinking was is that these bigger companies, obviously, you know, people like, you know, the Google that own Blogger are making sure that all the Blogger stuff is indexed because they're trying to draw people to the platform, and then they can maintain the back end and, you know, make sure it's got good bandwidth and it's, you know, performing well and it ranks well. And, you know, they're taking care of all that. And basically there's no cost to you to do that. You're just posting, where obviously there is a maintenance cost to maintain your own, you know, your own equipment or whatever.
Yeah, and that's true. And if you need a free solution, I say that's a good one. And even though Google does index Blogger, I would still say go with WordPress, because then if you do want to migrate to your own WordPress installation, you can just do an export and an import and have 90% of it there. That doesn't always actually sort it 100%. But, you know, if you do decide, hey, this is getting huge and I need to do something with it, you don't actually have to totally change platforms and looks and everything like that. You can kind of keep the same thing, but just grow it so that when you are ready to come in-house, you can in an easier way.
Okay, so
although you can also, there are, you know, you can export from Blogger and import into WordPress. You can move between most of those platforms pretty easily. So,
okay, so if we're sort of down the road of doing, you know, blog posts and those sort of things, I mean, what sort of frequency do you recommend? Obviously, it depends on how comfortable you feel, but what sort of a minimum frequency? Once a week, once a month, what's the length of a good blog post? Does it have to be, you know, two or three pages, or it can just be three or four paragraphs? Does it need a picture? I mean, what things tend to obviously, you know, be more appealing?
Sure. I would say pictures, unless that's your business, don't matter. So if you're in a visual business and, you know, you want to post pictures, so like if we post a new site to our portfolio, I'll post a picture of the site with that, you know, because it's about that we just did a site. So it'd be silly to write about it and not show people what we did. If I'm writing about SEO or about specific things, I don't always include pictures, and I don't think it's that big of a deal. People really come to read. So if the picture helps, post it. If it doesn't, don't worry about it. If you can't post more than once a month, you can still write a blog, but it's not going to gain traction. You can have posts that go. I have a blog that's maybe 6 years old. It still gets a ton of traffic off one post I wrote once. And I wrote three posts on this blog ever. And then I was like, okay, I don't need this anymore. I'm going to do something else. And one of the posts was about a fix to a WordPress plugin that let you add captions to pictures that otherwise the plugin didn't support. And I still get traffic to that post because people still look it up. How do I add captions to my pictures? How do I, you know, and I, for some reason, what I wrote was, you know, the thing that people type into search engines, and I got indexed and I get a lot of traffic from that post. So you can do a one-off and get good traffic that way. I'd say that you are more likely to succeed if you're doing once a month. And also, if you are a business and you're trying to gain viewers and traction, if you only have that one post, you know, people hit that blog. I've got links to my site. I don't really monetize that traffic because really they come for that answer and they leave, you know, and I don't have other stuff surrounding it. It's not like they come and they see that answer and then they're like, oh, wow, look at all this other stuff. I want to read this. I'm going to bookmark it, or I'm going to subscribe, you know, so that they send me an email when they put on new posts. So on some levels, if you really want to engage an audience, I'd say at least once a month, and ideally once a week is, you know, even better. And if you can write daily, fantastic. It's just, you know, I'd say between daily and every 2 weeks is kind of preference. And then if you can do every 2 weeks over a month, you should. And if you can do, you know, every week over 2 weeks, you should. I'm not sure that there's, you know, the posting daily versus weekly is that big of a deal. But less than once a month is, it just starts to look pretty sparse and you have a harder time bringing people in, because one of the things about blogs is if people like one thing and you write on a theme, they're likely to like other stuff, and the more other stuff you have, the more likely you are to pull them in and have them engaging with more of your content. And then even if they don't sign up, you know, if you run paid advertising or if you of promotions on different pages. The more pages they see, the more exposure they're getting to your different messages. So.
And how what's a you know what's a good length for a blog for an article? Does it need to be you know really long or you know is it going to be too short or you know does it matter? Is there a sort of a happy medium?
With blog posts, the same as with downloads, I would say that as long as it needs to be is the right length. And even with products, it's the same way. I mean, a lot of what I do is I work with people who sell information products, so ebooks and different reports. And some people will send you, you know, 5 binders and 29 DVDs in the mail. And I once bought a report for $100. It was one page. It was a one-page PDF. You know, it doesn't cost anything to fulfill. It's one page. It took him 3 minutes to write. I paid $100. I didn't ask for a refund because there was a promise. You know, he said, hey, I'm going to teach you this trick, and it's going to increase your business. I learned the trick. It increased my business. I'm like, okay, that's worth $100. And so I'd say for optimal length, it's really whatever length it takes to get your message across and not less than that and not more than that. You don't want to just ramble to fill space and you don't want to not get everything out there because you're trying to keep it in a page. So, you know, for SEO, there probably is a more optimum length, but SEO writing and, you know, good writing for your client base aren't always the same thing.
Okay, so I mean, you know, you do the blogs and that, but I mean, what about the traditional email marketing, the you know the email lists? I mean, are they still effective in this day and age? Do the people delete them? Do they actually read them?
Oh, I think that the email list is the most valuable asset a company has. Almost every company I know has hit. You hit critical mass, and that critical mass is a number of emails you have on your email list, and that is when you become certainly profitable. You know, and so as you build, you have 1,000 emails, and you have 2,000, you have 5,000, and at some point, that email list becomes the core of your company, and you can send out an email, and you can know that every time you send an email, you make between whatever it is, whatever your company is, but, you know, maybe between $500 and $10,000 per email on average for small businesses. And absolutely, people read them. You got to be careful. People will also spam you. They will get you blacklisted. They will unsubscribe. And so, you know, respect is huge. But I would say more than social media, more than any other medium, having someone's email is the most valuable thing that you can have off of them.
Okay. So, I mean, what tools do you recommend for those sort of email, you know, email lists?
Well, you know, like I mentioned, I'm an Infusionsoft certified consultant. I've been using Infusionsoft for ever, and I'm pretty in love with them. They are a great piece of software, and they're more than an email list. They do business automation, so they let you use business logic to dictate the emails so that you can say, you know, if someone has bought more than $500 in value from me over the last year and they didn't show up to this live event I ran, send them this special thing, inviting them to my next live event and giving them a special discount because they're a good customer. You know, or if someone has been on my list for more than 2 years and they've never bought anything from me, send them this, you know, like kind of client recovery offer. And if somebody is on my list and spends more than $100 a year, put them on this list that I give to my fulfillment house to buy them a birthday present and send it to them on their birthday. Like, you know, so you can use all sorts of crazy logic. And the more, I think that the more of that you do, the better, you know, the more targeted and specific. So automation is amazing. You can save so much time, but you don't want it to feel automated ever. You want to automate an amazing personal feeling. You want to use automation to free up your time so every interaction you make is more personal and you're not just bogged down with 1,000 emails and doing like one sentence replies and nobody ever feels like they get anything out of you. Like that's what I think. And so Infusions, it's kind of a higher end thing. It costs a couple thousand to get into and a couple $100 a month to run. And so it's not for everybody. Other than that, MailChimp is a great one, and it's free for one-off emails and maybe $20 a month for being able to do autoresponders where you have automatic messaging that goes out. AWeber, I think, is the same, about $20 a month for an autoresponder. Those are probably two of the better low-end ones, but, you know, and they only do email. whereas Infusionsoft actually does also your e-commerce and affiliate program management and website tracking, and you know, it's kind of a more integrated thing. So if it's just email, MailChimp and AWeber are two pretty good ones. And the other side of it, there's one shopping cart, which a lot of people use, which is somewhere in between. It also does your shopping cart, so it does email plus shopping cart. So it's a little bit more integrated. It's still not quite the same in terms of having the if-then logic that Infusionsoft does, but it's a good middle ground, and it's a bit cheaper. So those are the ones that come to mind.
Okay. So, I mean, there are plenty of options out there. And, I mean, I suppose the important thing is if you're not doing it, then it's something that you know, obviously need to do, and the tools are out there to help you achieve it. And I suppose the other side of the coin is it doesn't cost much to look at what others are doing in your industry and, you know, maybe subscribe to their newsletters and just see what sort of content they're pushing out as well. I mean, there's obviously a lot of content out. There's a lot of people doing the same sort of thing, obviously trying to attract people's attention. Is it something that you really have to, as you talked about, personalizing and being a bit different? Is that the angle that's going to make you successful?
Well, I mean, that comes back to sort of core business foundations and your USP and, you know, having a unique selling proposition. I think that's step one. If you don't have anything unique to offer, you're not really going to go anywhere. And, you know, maybe unique is you're the only pizza place in a 10-block radius. Yeah, maybe it's you're the only pizza place in a 2-block radius, depending on how big of a city you're in and like what kind of area you're in. But, you know, and maybe that unique selling proposition has to be more drastic than that. But I think that if you have a product, you need to know why. I'm a big fan of Jay Abraham, and one of the things that he used to write a lot about is just really the concept of making people's lives better and doing marketing from that perspective. So asking yourself, how do I make someone's life better? And why can I do a better job of that than someone else? You know, and if you can't really answer those questions, you don't really have a business, you know? And so those are the two things that you really want to know is, what are you doing to improve people's lives? How are you going to, you know, save them money or pain or add pleasure or make money? I mean, those are like the four biggest. Can you stop pain or increase pleasure? Can you make money or save money? People think about that all the time. And so if you can do one of those four things in any number of ways, you know, great. And in any business, you know, but price isn't always the best proposition. You can be the cheapest or you can be the best, you know, or you can fall somewhere in between and have a feature set that, you know, maybe the best is the most expensive. And maybe you fall in the middle and you serve a market that wants something better than the cheapest but can't afford the best. And so I think that you definitely have to know that. And whether or not that includes your personality is a question. I'd say most of the time these days, companies are trying to get more and more personal. And they're letting their employees blog and, you know, their CEO is blogging. There's faces to the company, and I think people do like that. It doesn't have to be that way, though. But if it's not you that's the great thing that stands out, it has to be your product or it has to be your offering. Something has to stand out to have an effective business, certainly.
Okay. So, I mean, as we approach sort of the end of our time here, what about the referral business? How do you – you know, in your experience, what's the best way to drive referrals? Because that's generally what most people in small business refer to as their main lead generation source. They get referred to businesses from existing clients and prospects. I mean, is that something that, you know, you should just let happen naturally? Or is there some way that you can look at actually driving that to, you know, improve the referrals or spur them along?
Sure. Referrals are huge. And again, the more that you can automate the process or have a process, even if it's not automated, a process that you know, the better. So there's a couple different levels to that. You know, there's the personal referral. So you have a customer, they buy. At some point, depending on if your product takes time to consume or if it instantly people like it or not, you know, you send out an email saying, hey, how do you like it? And if you can survey them at that point and get a response, you know, I loved it, it was okay, I didn't really like it, then you take the bad responses and you throw them at customer support and you try to either make them happy or figure out what's wrong with your product. And you take the good responses and you write back and you say, oh, I'm glad you loved it. Would you mind providing a testimonial? You know, and here's a little form that you can send this to 3 friends. If you're a brick and mortar business, you can give out cards that have, you know, give this to a friend and they'll get $5 off or whatever. You know, so there's that personal referral. Then there's more peer-to-peer referrals. So I'm a web design company and I work with other people. I offer 15% lifetime payout on referrals. So if you refer me business and they buy anything from me, I give you 15% of that. You know, that's a solidified program that I run. And so there's SEO companies that don't do web design. They have an SEO client that's like, well, you've got to redo your site or it's not even worthy of being SEO'd. They throw the business to me. I give them a commission, you know, so like codified structures like that are also fantastic. And then it's just about finding the people who serve your same market, but don't compete. And so the other thing that you can do then is also trade and have things where you tell your audience about their business and they tell their audience about yours. So if you know that you've got another business that serves your same market and has your same demographic, you can figure out ways that it doesn't cost either of you anything, but you've got a more powerful referral network than just your clients. Definitely clients, you should have a process. At what point after they buy, do you ask them whether they're happy? And then if they say they're happy, get a testimonial and ask them to tell friends and do it explicitly. Like maybe offer them something, tell 3 friends and we'll give you a 10% off, you know, but like, I think that most companies don't do that. And that's huge. That can blow up your business. That one thing alone.
And the testimonials, do you put them on the website? Where do you start using those?
Yeah, anywhere. Website, printed advertising, you know, if you do radio advertising, get audio testimonials you can use. The only thing you have to make sure is that it's credible, that it sounds like a real person really talking about your business. You don't want overblown testimonials that are just ridiculous. You know, even if you have one client who got miraculous results, you might not want to focus on that one testimonial if it's not representative. Because that's just, you know, that's what people have done for a long time. It's standard marketing. And I think that the average audience these days has a nose for that. And it's no longer as effective as it once was. People are more likely to read things that sound realistic. And to be honest, also, if you're a brick and mortar business, one of the better ways to do it is ask them to go to your Google Places profile and post their feedback there, because that then helps your place show up higher up on maps and in Google listings when people search it. So if it's something that, you know, people would look up on Google to try to find your location to come in, doing it on either Google Places or Yelp or one of the sort of map services that aggregates that as well helps. And any feedback is good. There's been studies that show that having negative feedback among positive testimonials on Amazon improves your sales because people feel like it's more realistic.
Yeah, exactly. I think the important thing is that you get benefit from the positive, you know, and the negative, you know, reviews. The important thing is you've got a review or you've got feedback that you can act on. So, I mean, a positive one's great, you know, but again, it's not much use getting a positive review and then just sitting on it and doing nothing with it. I think you need to obviously leverage that. And the negative ones, like I said, you need to take it back to customer service or look at your own product and say, well, you know, how can I improve this and how can I avoid this happening again? So I think in all respects, you know, all feedback's good and it's something that you need to take action on.
And there's also, you know, the same with social media. It's an opportunity for you to react. And I've heard more than one time in the news, and so this is actually something that got a company into the news and newsworthy, that somebody was mad. They posted something on Twitter. I heard this about an airline, you know. I can't remember what happened. They were mad. They had a bad experience. The airline's like, have a free ticket. They posted back to them. You know, all of a sudden, they're in the news, first of all, for doing that. And second of all, people who see that when they come across like their social profile page are like, wow, okay, so not only do they see that people had a complaint, but they see that the company dealt with it in a positive light, which also I think is a big credibility factor, because most people are worried that the customer service of everyone that they're ever going to work with is going to be bad, and that they're going to wait on hold for 4 hours, and then they're going to talk to someone who doesn't speak their language, and it's not going to be a good experience. And so when you can provide a good experience, even from people that have bad feedback, if you can do that in a semi-transparent way, you know, it gives everyone else a little bit of comfort.
Okay. Well, like I said, I think that's you know, obviously some great advice there, and we probably could spend a lot more time talking about all this, but we do need to wrap up our chat today. What I'll get Justin to do, obviously, is if he's mind, a bit of a summation of what we've discussed today, just some hit some major points and some recommendations for the small to medium business, what they could be doing or should be doing with their promotion and their lead generation there. And then finally, if you can just let everybody know how they can get in touch with you if they want more information about your business and what you do. So if you could just round off for us, Justin, that'd be great.
Sure. So in terms of recommendations, I'd say that the biggest thing, if you don't know what lifecycle marketing is, look it up and then think about your customer lifecycle. So think about how are you getting leads in the door? How are you nurturing those leads once you've got their contact information to make them more likely to buy? How are you getting them to buy? And once they buy, how are you following up with them to try to get referral business from them? And, you know, look at the customer over its whole life. And then there's also actually, once you buy, how are you upselling them? How are you getting them to engage more deeply or buy more from you until they're done with you? You know, I would say that the biggest thing is to look at that and figure out what all of those steps look like for your business. And then once you know that, if you can get into a system that helps with that, and there's all sorts of options out there, you know, find software. There's a lot of really good marketing software that exists today. Find something that can help you with those things and make it as easy as possible on you to follow up. And whether that's just a little reminder system that says, hey, don't forget, you know, you need to follow up with these people to get their feedback, or whether it's a complex CRM that does it for you, that's just up to your level. And if you want to learn more about what I do, my company is called Narasopa Media, and it's online at narasopamedia.com. It's NARASOPA. And that's about that.
Okay, so
you can learn more about what I do there, and
all right, well, I'll take all those.
My blog posts that say more.
All right, I'll take all those that information. I'll post up when we post up the episode, but I'll take the opportunity to thank Justin on behalf of all the listeners in this episode of the Need to Know podcast. Thanks very much for listening, and tune in for the next episode. This podcast has been brought to you by the CIOps Publications. For more information, visit www.ciaops.com/publications. To provide feedback on this podcast, visit www.ciaops.com/contact.